From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. There's an arc of crisis stretching across the heartland of Eurasia. Tension and conflict from the former Soviet republics to Pakistan and India poses a complex and compelling threat to world stability and international security. No conflict better exemplifies the tangled skein of ethnic, religious, and political forces involved in these animosities than the contest between India and Pakistan for control of Kashmir. With us today to discuss the problem of Kashmir is Sumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Hunter College of the City University of New York. Sumit, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
I know that you are just returned from the region, so we're going to call on you not only for your scholarship, but also your most recent impressions from what you've learned there. Before that, though, Sumit, let me begin with this question, because we're going to talk today about regional conflicts. And I think for Americans, this is quite a new topic. And to see it as a major factor in international security is also quite new for us, whether it's Bosnia, Sudan, Nagorno-Karabakh, or Kashmir. So I guess the first question might be this. Why, Sumit, as someone who has studied these, do you think that these regional conflicts merit our national concern and attention? And then as a second part of that, why do they seem so vicious and intractable so often?
I think they merit our concern and attention principally because the major conflict that had animated U.S. foreign policy in the post-war era has for the most part dissipated. One still worries about the presence of nuclear weapons in the successor states of the Soviet Union. That does remain a concern. The transition to a market and a democratic set of institutions also remains questions of concern. So it's not that the central the central conflict has dissipated in large measure, nevertheless, to some degree, the successor states of the Soviet Union and their transitions to the market and to democratic institutions will remain an important concern in American foreign policy. But having said that, regional conflicts will sort of become almost paradigmatic in the foreseeable future, if they haven't become already, principally because the U.S. as the sole global power that remains a global power in that the United States still possesses military power on a scale that no other country possesses, despite the doldrums of the American economy finds itself in at the moment, the long-term future of the American economy remains quite robust. Mm-hmm. And above all, this is something that is not adequately stressed. For good or ill, American ideas, American notions, American values have percolated almost mm-hmm. throughout the world. Consequently, the U.S. will remain engaged.
The way you state that suggests to me, Sumit, that you see it as a question of responsibility for
exactly.
this country.
Exactly. I mm-hmm. see it as a question of American responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn our focus directly now to Kashmir as an example, emblematic, I would think, of the kind of regional conflict we're talking about. Let me pose the question this way, Sumit. When I think of Kashmir, it has a romantic sound, a fabled land of great beauty and with a very complex religious and ethnic makeup. Now, given that perception, and then, of course, given the sort of tension and conflict in that region today, one question immediately comes to fore. Where are the roots of this? Where are the roots of the conflict in Kashmir? What's causing the trouble in Kashmir?
The roots of the conflict are essentially twofold. One are sort of the long-term roots of the conflict, and then one can talk about the more proximate roots of the conflict. The origins of the conflict have to do with the process of colonial disengagement. at the time of independence and partition of the India and Pakistan in 1947, when Britain was sort of disengaging, giving up its colonial empire in South Asia, there were two distinct sort of forms of nationalism that had emerged. One, which would ultimately culminate in the state of Pakistan, based upon the claim that the Muslims of South Asia had the right to a homeland, that they constituted a nation unto themselves in the pristine sense of the word.
In other words, a nation built around religious identity.
Exactly. Nation built around, coalesced around religious identity.
All right.
The challenging vision, which was propagated by India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, coming out of the British liberal tradition, argued that there was a possibility of secular nationalism, that one could build a nationalism around a secular identity, and as a consequence, the Kashmir became sort of the epicenter of this whole debate, in that under British colonial rule, and I'm afraid I will have to go into some detail over here. I will try and keep it limited, but nevertheless, some detail is called for. Under the aegis of British colonial rule, there were two kinds of states in British India. One were the states directly ruled by Britain. The other were these 562 so-called princely states, which were notionally independent, but defense, foreign affairs, and communications were vested in the British Crown. As long as the rulers of these native states maintained a modicum of order, Britain would not intervene. There was a regent or a political agent who would be appointed to the monarch. And as long as the monarch paid obeisance to the British crown, the monarch would be left alone.
Is this the concept of paramountcy?
This is the doctrine of paramountcy.
In other words, Britain remains the
paramount power in the subcontinent.
Okay, good.
Lord Mountbatten, the last viceroy, argued that the doctrine of paramountcy was on the verge of lapsing with British withdrawal from the subcontinent. Consequently, the rulers had to choose either India or Pakistan, depending upon two factors: their demographic composition. If they were predominantly Muslim, they would go to Pakistan, and also their geographic location. Kashmir posed a peculiar problem because it had a Hindu monarch and a predominantly Muslim population, and its borders abutted both India and Pakistan. On one side, what was going to become Pakistan, on the other side, India. In a strict moral sense, Kashmir should have gone to Pakistan. Except the tragedy is that the Pakistani leadership under Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the first Governor General of Pakistan, it is not clear that it was done with Jinnah's full knowledge and connivance, but certainly with the tacit acceptance. A rebellion spontaneously arose on the northern borders of Kashmir, on the western borders of Kashmir, and taking advantage of this, Pakistani troops dressed as local tribesmen joined the fray.
So this was seen by India as a clear provocation.
This was seen by India as a clear provocation. The Maharaja himself, the ruler of Kashmir, the monarch of Kashmir, a man called Hari Singh, was entertaining visions of independence. He wanted to join neither India nor Pakistan.
But this was not possible.
This was not possible.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Lord Mountbatten had made it amply clear that one could join either India or Pakistan, but independence was not going to be countenanced by any of the three parties, Britain, India, or Pakistan. At which point the Maharaja appealed to Nehru for assistance. Nehru said, I will provide you assistance on two conditions, if two conditions are met. A, you accede to India, and B, I will have to consult someone in the absence of a referendum, since under these conditions one cannot hold a referendum. Mm-hmm. In the absence of a referendum, I will do the next best thing.
Right.
So he consulted a man called Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah, who was the leader of the largest secular and notionally democratic organization. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize notionally because Abdullah, even though he used sort of the language of democratic discourse, for all practical purposes was a highly authoritarian, if charismatic, leader. Mm-hmm. Now, Abdullah had come under sort of Nehru's influence in the 1930s because both of them were sort of acolytes of Fabian socialism. And Abdullah said, yes, you have my imprimatur on the instrument of accession. And accordingly, only after obtaining Abdullah's support, and there is little question that Abdullah commanded vast support both amongst Hindus and Muslims in the valley because of his opposition to the Maharaja's autocratic rule.
Right. So in this way, Nehru was sort of assured of the means to to unite Kashmir or to keep Kashmir under Indian authority,
and also to cloak it with a form of legitimacy.
I see
that it was not merely the accession would not merely be legal, but would also have an aura of legitimacy to it,
and perhaps moral authority as
and
well.
Perhaps and moral authority, yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Those are the very words mm-hmm. I would have used. Mm-hmm. At which point, Indian troops were sent in late 1947, and a sort of a war ensued. And Pakistan came to occupy 1/3 of Kashmir, and India came to occupy 2/3 of Kashmir. And that stalemate, for the most part, has remained ever since. And India referred the case to the United Nations Security Council under the advice of Lord Mountbatten. Mm-hmm. Alas, the Kashmir case quickly became enmeshed in the politics of the Cold War, and it was not decided. The various resolutions that were passed on Kashmir were not sort of pristine resolutions looking at purely the legal merits of the case.
Right. Tell me this, Shumit, because I did, as I mentioned earlier in the program, want to bring in not just the fact that you study and write about the region with such depth and understanding, but you just come back from it. If you were to update our story briefly,
yes,
against the historical context you've given us, what would you say about things as they stand right now in early 1994? What's the exact state of affairs at this moment?
Yeah. It's about the worst they've been since 1947. Now, obviously, I haven't lived during this entire period or have not had a working life during this entire period, but from my knowledge of contemporary affairs, or the sort of the contemporary history of Kashmir, at no point since 1947 has the situation in Kashmir been worse. Mm. It's a situation of unremitting violence, particularly located in the valley. There are three components to Kashmir. One is Ladakh, which abuts China and almost touches portions of the former Soviet Union. The other is the state of Jammu, which is the southern part of Kashmir. And then there is the Kashmir Valley, which is really the area of contestation.
Is this the Vale of Kashmir?
This is the Vale of Kashmir.
The famous Vale.
This is the famed Vale of Kashmir about which, you know, saints and poets have imagined many things. I mean, this is a place of almost utopian beauty.
Yes, yes.
Of extraordinary physical beauty. I mean, truly breathtaking beauty. And this is where the conflict is located. And it's a spiral of violence. People talk about a circle of violence, but a circle is an inappropriate metaphor. A spiral captures it better because it's a mounting graph of violence with, in one sense, one is highly critical of India's security forces, particularly the paramilitary forces, less so the army. The army, working under the most extraordinary difficult conditions, has maintained a modicum of discipline. But the paramilitary forces, which are ill-trained, which are inadequately paid, which have not been trained in urban guerrilla warfare, all too often have resorted to excessive force, and in a way that's counterproductive.
Yeah.
In these cordon and search operations, all too often they are disrespectful of women and are treat children harshly.
This is yet, in its tragic way, Shumit, another striking example, I think, of just how emblematic the Kashmiri conflict is, because this business of ill-trained militias abusing population seems to be a constant in these kinds of things.
There's little question about
it. Yeah.
And unfortunately, the guerrillas have also resorted to certain tactics of kidnapping, of selective assassination, and using human shields and the like, which only provokes reactions from the security forces, which, I mean, one has to condemn the actions of the security forces, but to some extent, one can also understand how order and discipline break down under these conditions.
Absolutely. You know what I would like for us to do, Shumit, is look in some depth at the approaches and strategies of both India and Pakistan in this matter. And to do that, I would love to have you explain first something that comes from your writing that I think is very useful, not just to understand Kashmir, but indeed to understand other nation states and regional conflicts throughout the world. You've developed or written about a concept called the weak, strong state. And I think that both Pakistan and India might fit that category. Tell us first what that means.
This is a concept that's widely used in the study of political science today. There weak states in that their institutions are not adequately developed. Civil society is particularly poorly developed, both in India and Pakistan to varying degrees. But at the same time, they are strong states in that their coercive powers are extraordinary. You have highly bloated bureaucracies which wield enormous coercive power and have systematically constricted, particularly in Pakistan, less so in India, because in India there's still some countervailing institutions which at least exist in skeletal form. They may not be full-blooded and full-bodied, but they do exist in skeletal form and do in a rickety fashion continue to stumble along. Whereas in Pakistan, owing to well over 10 years of military rule, most of these institutions were systematically eroded. As a consequence, the coercive powers of the state filled the vacuum. And the tragedy is that neither India nor Pakistan can be ruled with an iron fist. These are societies which are polyethnic, which are multi-religious, and in a sense, I certainly would argue this for India and would like to extend the argument to Pakistan, that these both states are really doomed to some form of democracy.
Yes.
The only way you can accommodate, to use that Churchillian phrase about democracy substituting, you know, the counting of heads for the cracking of heads, applies perhaps universally, I would like to believe, but nowhere with a greater sense of immediacy than India and Pakistan.
Sumit, to focus our attention even more keenly on India's interest in Kashmir, let me pose this question to you. I have a sense that you could say the Kashmiri problem for India has both internal and external dimensions to it. And if that's correct, I would like to take them in order and ask you to characterize them for us. I mean, internally, in the sense of the Indian political system, what is the threat that the Kashmiri problem represents?
This is an extraordinarily helpful question. Let me see if I can outline the various components of the internal dimension. The first is there is a real fear. Whether or not this fear is sort of empirically grounded is a separate issue. But the fear is widely shared amongst the Indian elite that if Kashmir is allowed to leave the Indian Union, this would set in motion centrifugal forces that could lead to, there's a marvelous term which was coined by Britishers called fissiparous tendencies. This would set in motion a whole series of fissiparous tendencies. It was popularized actually by an eminent American journalist, Selig Harrison, in a book called India, the Most Dangerous Decades.
For the rest of us, would that be splitting off?
Splitting off. That's exactly, yes. Centrifugal forces would be set in motion. Mm-hmm. That if today it's Kashmir, tomorrow it could be Punjab, and heaven only knows what next. And India, as a polyethnic society which has had secessionist movements in the past and has lost considerable blood and treasure in the process of nation building, this is an understandable fear. That's the first dimension. The second one, even though Indian secularism is in a kind of a moth-eaten state today, given the rise of the Hindu right and also the compromises the Indian state has made to religious parties and to religious groups in recent years, owing to the exigencies of domestic politics. At some level, it is vitally important to preserve Indian secularism, and it's a tragedy that it has to be preserved in this fashion.
Didn't want to jump in, but you really stimulated my thought on that.
Yes.
Because once again, that could be a fissiparous reaction, could it not?
Of course.
I mean, because India does have so many religions and cultures.
Indeed.
I see.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And the notion is that if Kashmir is allowed to secede on the grounds that it has a predominantly Muslim population, then all bets are off, in a sense. Then religion and religious affiliation and the concentration of a religious group in a particular area becomes the basis for nationhood challenging the very cornerstone of the Indian state.
Right.
So this is a second component. The third is, states, particularly post-colonial states, have an obsession with borders. Territoriality, as Max Weber told us in the 19th century, and the control of territory is one of the hallmarks of the modern nation state.
Right.
And if you have to concede a portion of your territory, it's like perhaps not being decapitated, but perhaps having an arm or a leg removed.
Yeah, as we have seen elsewhere in the world. Is this an example? Are we moving now into the dimension where it becomes an external or regional concern for India?
Of course. Mm-hmm. And particularly to lose territory to Pakistan, its principal rival. And in a sense, India and Pakistan are joined at the hip. And Pakistan sees this as vitally important for two reasons. One, because Pakistan has always maintained that it has a irredentist claim to Kashmir, given that the Kashmiris are ethnically, at least one dimension of their ethnicity is the same as that of other Pakistanis, meaning they're predominantly Muslim. So there is an irredentist claim to Kashmir. And in addition to that, there is a more cynical element, and I can entirely understand it. It was India's intervention that was the critical variable that permitted Bangladeshi nationalism to come to the fore.
That's right.
And ultimately to create the state of Bangladesh.
In the early 70s.
In the early 70s, mm-hmm. in 1971 in particular. Mm-hmm. And number of the Pakistani elite felt humiliated and still have very strong memories of the 1971 episode. And here is an opportunity to pay India back in its own coin.
Shumit, so much to talk to you about. Let me take a moment, though, just to say this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Shumit Ganguly, currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Shumit Ganguly is professor of political science at Hunter College of the City University of New York, and among his books are The Origins of War in South Asia, and The Hope and the Reality, U.S.-Indian Relations from Roosevelt to Reagan. The title of his current project is The Kashmir Problem Revisited. You know, where you brought us, Shumit, with that exposition, and indeed all we've talked about, is to the obvious question, what should be done about all of this? And, of course, there are different ways of looking at that, depending upon where you sit, whether it's in Pakistan or India or here today on Dialogue. And I think I'll take advantage of our perspective and your thinking about it. It seems to me Kashmir is part of India, so clearly the weight of this question might rest, the gravamen, with what India's action should be. Now, you have looked into this, and from everything from the status quo to independence to other solutions, what is the best solution for India in this? What is the best thing they should do?
I think there are a number of things that the Indian state can do to bring about not only order, but also bring about a modicum of legitimacy to its position within Kashmir. I think it will entail offering significant concessions to Pakistan on a number of related issues. Number one would be the Siachen Glacier. India, as the largest state in the region, can demonstrate a spirit of generosity and can make unilateral concessions.
Resolve that war.
It would save Pakistan and India enormous resources, and it would put an end to this bloodletting that continues even as we speak. Furthermore, it would permit a Pakistani prime minister to go home and say, look, I brought this back. Siachen is in our hands. Secondly, India could also make concessions to Pakistan on an issue which is highly divisive, has to do with the sharing of river waters along something called the Wuller Barrage. Mm-hmm. And the third is an area called Sir Creek. It has to do with the maritime boundary. Again, India could demonstrate a spirit of generosity there. Fourthly, India could offer to make minor territorial adjustments along the border so that certain enclaves that jut into Pakistani territory or what Pakistan considers to be its territory could well become Pakistani territory and Indian troops would retreat, thereby providing Pakistan certain kinds of strategic salience and a degree of reassurance against a longstanding adversary.
Those I understand quite clearly. I think those are well expounded.
Yes.
Within Kashmir, would India have to cede any autonomy or do anything?
Significant. And that's exactly the right word. Autonomy is the right word. India could return Kashmir to its pre-1952 status, under which India only controlled defense, foreign affairs, and communications. Everything else could be returned to the Kashmiris. as long as minority rights in Kashmir were protected, the government of India would provide a constitutional dispensation by which Kashmiris would be allowed a degree of freedom unknown to virtually any other Indian citizen. I see democracy and federalism as a far better option than sort of permitting self-determination in a willy-nilly fashion, because self-determination often does not address the problem of the rights of minorities within minorities.
It seems to me what you're really saying with that remarkable exposition of the points that that should constitute a peace discussion and a peace settlement is that you're really challenging the Indian leadership to display a spirit of foresight, courage, and generosity.
Indeed.
That's exactly what's at stake.
Mm-hmm.
Shumit, to conclude our conversation, I'd like to take us back, in a sense, to where we began it, because we began talking about, in a sense, the American interest. In other words, why Americans should pay attention and why this conflict is important to us here and to the West and to the world outside of the region. And I think your larger point is that all these regional conflicts are going to be important to the world outside of the given region. If that is so, and I suspect it is, then what, in your opinion, does that suggest to Americans as policymakers or as concerned citizens? What is the role that they should play constructively in all of this?
Given that I recognize certain political realities, given that an administration has a finite amount of time, this administration or any other, and has a finite amount of emotional, intellectual, and material resources to devote to any number of conflicts, one cannot reasonably expect a major commitment of resources to Kashmir. However, a certain amount of resources does need to be committed to Kashmir for the simple reason. I think there are a couple of different reasons. One, I think it's humanitarian. The bloodletting that is going on is quite significant, and one should not be oblivious to human suffering, particularly when one has the capability to act, to limit that suffering. I think this may sound terribly idealistic, but I think a modicum of idealism is important. We should not become callous to human suffering. Secondly, I think there is a more strategic interest, and that if this violence continues, if this civil war continues to fester, there is a possibility of inadvertent conflict, which could lead to a fourth round Indo-Pakistani conflict, at which point the U.S. would be forced to intervene, and forced to intervene using far more resources. And it would be forced to intervene because the danger of escalating to nuclear war would always be present. I'm not saying it would be imminent, but it would be lurking in the background, and with the possibility of a regional nuclear war looming in the distance, the U.S. would have little or no choice but to intervene, and the costs of intervention at that point would be substantially higher. Mm-hmm. So this is almost like a therapeutic measure, mm-hmm. To lance the boil before it actually bursts.
I appreciate the image, and I think your point is very well taken and persuasive. Thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue, Shumit.
It's indeed been a pleasure.
It's an all mine. Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Shumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Hunter College of the City University of New York. I am George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.